Okay, please turn your Bibles to the book of Proverbs. Continuing our survey of the Old Testament. And tonight we're looking at Proverbs for the second time, taking another run at it. And the first time we looked at basic principles of interpreting Proverbs. And we also looked at what we should not be. In Proverbs, we see things by contrast. And sometimes we see what we should be like by what we should not be like. And we looked at the slothful and the fool as two of the main things that kind of pop out from Proverbs of what we should not be. We should not be like the fool, and we should not be like the slothful one, the sluggard, the lazy one. And again, we've titled it Wisdom for the Ambitious. Wisdom for the ambitious. The thing about ambition is those who have goals, those who have things they want to achieve, they want, in a sense, the good life, right? We all seek that, in a certain sense, the good life. And in our various family and friendships and the words we use with other people, etc., we want to achieve the good life. And tonight is part two, and we're looking at the positive side of things from Proverbs. We're looking at the family, looking at friendship, we're looking at words, and we're looking at life and death tonight. And there is some contrast that's presented, obviously, within each of these, but because contrast is the mother of clarity. But godly wisdom is what the main theme of Proverbs, godly wisdom. And in the family, when we're thinking about the family, the wise and godly life pays close attention to the family. And the book of Proverbs is largely presented as a father and a mother teaching a son. Okay, if you look at chapter 1, verse 8, look at chapter 1, verse 8. It says here, "My son, hear the instruction of your father, and do not forsake the law of your mother." And if you go to chapter 31, verses 1 and 2, chapter 31, verses 1 and 2, so essentially here is the words of King Lemuel's mother. "The words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. What, my son? And what, son of my womb? And what, son of my vows?" And then goes on. So it's essentially instruction from a mother. So the whole book itself is presented as instruction from parents to a son. We'll look at two parts that kind of main themes that kind of come out in the book of Proverbs: the married couple and the children. The married couple and the children. Now, I'll say this, and this is has been debated in the history of philosophy: is are we solely individuals, and are our social relationships whatever we want them to be? Just human constructs, okay? There are some philosophers who look at it that way, that radical individualism, that all we are is individuals, and any type of social relationship is arbitrary. It's whatever we want it to be, okay? That's obviously false, but you'll see that out there in some libertarianism, it's called. Radical individualism, that all we are is individuals. Well, I got news for them. God has created us as individuals, but he's also created us as social creatures by nature. In the very beginning, we think of God created Adam and Eve, a companion, a friend, and that they would form a marriage. The two shall become one and have children. So we are by nature social creatures, not just individuals. And God is the one then that lays out the obligations and duties within the family that he has created. When we think of the married couple, you think of, turn over to chapter 5. Chapter 5, I'll read here verses 15 through 19. This is in the middle of a section on the danger of adultery. Okay? But drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. In other words, for a husband or wife, have sex with your own spouse only. Don't seek outside of your marriage relationship. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth as a loving deer and a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. So what do you have? You have this sense of joy that should be there between husband and wife, and only between husband and wife. We see that a husband's jealousy for his wife is quite natural. Look over at chapter 6, verse 34. For jealousy is a husband's fury. Therefore, he will not spare in the day of vengeance. And this is pretty common among the history of murder. Just as a lawyer speaking to you, is for your knowledge, is let's say a husband walked in on his wife committing adultery with a man, some other man, and he walked in on that right then. Filled with jealousy and rage, and let's say he kills him. He just loses his mind with rage and jealousy and anger, and he kills him. We have in the history of our statutes is there's a defense for murder, that it typically goes from murder down to a lesser crime of voluntary manslaughter. Because we know that a husband's jealousy for his wife is quite natural. And he could get so enraged that he could lose all reason at that moment. And as it says here, for jealousy is a husband's fury, therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. And that makes sense. The danger of adultery is presented quite thoroughly in various parts of Proverbs. Let's look at a little bit here. Chapter 2, verse 16. To deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. And you'll find this theme of flattery. Okay? And I presented this with my class in Romans, the book of Romans, with flattery. Lord willing, if we can meet in the coming weeks for Sunday morning worship service, Lord willing, I'll present it again with dealing with adultery in the Sermon on the Mount, and false teaching. But with flattery is somebody that comes to you and they tell you how good you are. Just come with words, smooth words and flattering speech, like the false teachers in Romans chapter 16. With flattery. And they come and they want to tell you how good you are. Oh, you're good. And you know, that spouse of yours, that husband or wife, you know, they don't treat you like I would. You know, they wouldn't appreciate you like. And that Douglas, the one pastor, theologian Douglas Wilson, has written a book and focused a lot on that, of the flattery that comes out through Proverbs. That one of the main weapons of the adulterer or the adulteress is flattery. Smooth words and flattering speech. And they want to butter you up and tell you how good you are and how bad the other person is and all of that. Look at chapter 6. Turn over to chapter 6. So he's warning of the danger then and the tactics of the adulterer and the adulteress. Look at chapter 6, verse 24. To keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. And there's warning of danger. So of he who goes in to his neighbor's wife, that he'll the verse prior in verse 28, shall his feet not be seared. You know, at the end of verse 29, whoever touches her shall not be innocent. There's great dangers. Chapter 7, verse 5, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. See, that constant theme keeps coming through. And that's the same with false teachers. And I'll get to that in a minute, okay? Because in the backdrop of this, think, in the Old Testament, just keep this in the back of your mind, in the Old Testament, God's relationship with his people is described as a marriage, and it is not to be marked by adultery. And that's why false teachers are presented like the adulterer or the adulteress, coming in with smooth words and flattery speech, trying to draw you away from the one that you're in marriage with, God. Let's see. Chapter 22, verse 14, just a couple more here. Chapter 22, verse 14, the mouth of an immoral woman is a deep pit. He who is abhorred by the Lord will fall there. And there you deal with the mouth again, with the flattering speech and all of that. Chapter 23, verse 27, for a harlot is a deep pit, and a seductress is a narrow well. Chapter 30, verse 20. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done no wickedness. Dealing with the danger, you can add, I mean, there's much in Proverbs, but chapter 7, verse 27, again, these are just high points. But the greatest danger of all, obviously, is hell. Chapter 7, verse 27, her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. And there's other verses, too. You think of the adulterous person in chapter 2, verses 16 through 19, most of chapter 5, chapter 5, 1 through 23, chapter 6, verses 20 to 35, all of chapter 7, chapter 9, verses 13 to 18. In other words, that's a big theme when you really drive through Proverbs. Now, there's wisdom here. You think about it a minute. You think of secular psychologists like Sigmund Freud, who tried to, in his own secular, unbelieving way of looking at the human species, said the strongest drive within a human being is a sex drive. That's his observation as an unbeliever thinking about observing human beings. Well, Proverbs is full of godly wisdom, and it knows there's great, great danger when the sex drive is not controlled, not self-governed by God's grace. But in the Old Testament, God's relationship with his people is described as a marriage. Same in the New Testament. We'll be getting to this like James 4:4 that I've got in a couple places. You can put this next to this one too. For instance, go to James, just hold your finger there and go to James 4:4. We'll refer to this a couple of different times, dealing with friendships. The greatest friend, earthly friend, that a man or woman has is their husband and wife, right? God created a companion for Adam. It's not good that he was alone. He got the best friend there was, Eve. among human beings, right? Yes. Well, the greatest friend we have is God, and that's in our marriage with God. Ephesians 5 talks about that too, with our marriage with Christ. But look at James 4:4. That's why does it start out here? Adulterers and adulteresses. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Why would it start with adulterers and adulteresses? Why? It's because we're in a marriage relationship with Christ, with God. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Ephesians 5:25. And we're acting just like an adulterer or an adulteress in our relationship with God if we seek to be a friend of the world. So the point there is, in our own relationships, in our own marriages, in our relationship with God, we're to avoid adultery. And there should be integrity. There should be wholeness. There should be holiness. And you can see things stressed like that in chapter 3, verse 33, chapter 12, verse 17, chapter 14, verse 11, chapter 17, verse 13, chapter 21, verse 12. The emphasis on integrity. You know, you deal with the jealous. We mentioned it's natural for a husband to be jealous, to be angry, right? Chapter 6, verse 34, for jealousy is a husband's fury, therefore you will not spare in the day of vengeance. Well, what do you see there in chapter 3, verse 33? We're in a marriage relationship with God. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, and he blesses the home of the just. Right? What does it say in the second commandment of the Ten Commandments? Our God is a jealous God. Right? He visits the iniquity of the fathers unto the third and fourth generation of those who hate him, but he shows mercy unto thousands of them that love him and keep his commandments. But he's a jealous God. Why? We're in covenant relationship with him. We're in a marriage relationship with him. And that's why the curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked when we've been an adulterer or an adulteress spiritually. And that's a theme that goes through in those verses that I listed. Okay. The children. It's got lots of things to say to the children here, right? And parents on raising and teaching children. The main thing parents must do is teach their children, and discipline is key. Discipline is key in teaching, and that comes out in the book of Proverbs. Look at chapter 29, verse 15. Chapter 29, verse 15, the rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. Now, we had a session here, remember, a while back, and we talked about corporal discipline, bodily discipline. And in our legal system in the United States, it's a form of physical assault. But our statutes allow exceptions for parents. Okay, they carve out exceptions, and the main, you don't want bruises and all of that. That's not good. But the main place that our courts have allowed is on the butt. Okay, that's a real safe place of using some type of a good swat with the hand or a little bitty paddle, and the little child will get the point when you're trying to teach the child what's right and wrong and when they have disobeyed you. Okay, we don't want child abuse. The Bible does not in any way ever support child abuse, but it does support bodily discipline, especially spanking on the butt. And having a child cry over that is okay. The whole point is you're showing you love the child. We'll get to that too. But again, a child who receives no bodily discipline, they'll end up bringing shame to the parent. That's what this proverb is saying. But the rod and rebuke gives wisdom. Because you want to teach, again, you want to explain, again, I'll say this too, is it's good to explain to the child what they did that was wrong, that they disobeyed. Explain to them that your authority is granted from God, and therefore they must obey. And they keep refusing to obey, then there comes a spanking time. Chapter 19, verse 18. Chasten is a word for discipline. Chasten. Chapter 19, verse 8. Chasten your son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. And that's something we stress too, and we had that session on parental discipline of children, is they found bodily discipline works best at a given period there, probably about 2 years of age to maybe 4 years of age. There's a period of time there. You wait too long, it's easier to bend an oak tree when it's young. You go try and bend an oak tree out here when it's 20 years old. You're not going to bend it much. But when it's young, right? That's the same with human beings. Chapter 22, verse 15. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Doctrine of total depravity, right? We're born that way, right? Because of Adam. When Adam sinned, we sinned all. Romans 5:12. So in our hearts, the problem is corrupt hearts. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. In chapter 23, verses 13 and 14. Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, so we're talking about spanking on the butt, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell. It's pretty serious stuff. We can do that? Thirteen 24 is another, and there are a lot, and that's the within the book. 13:24, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. And I've got some more on that down here too, that we'll get to. It's chapter 3, verse 12, 11 and 12 is very closely to those verses there, to chapter 13, verse 24. Good cross-reference is chapter 3, 11 and 12. So do you love your child is the point. If parents really love their child, you've got to go through the tough. You got to be a parent. You got to go through the situation of tough love. If you don't discipline the child, you're showing before God you don't love the child. And you'll end up with children that are absolutely spoiled. It won't drive the foolishness out of the child. Now I'll say this. I'll add this in here. Sunday school started in the 1800s. In the history of the church, Sunday school started in the 1800s to help parental teaching, not replace it. Who's responsible to teach their children? According to the Bible? Parents. Parents. Sunday school is to help, so parents should be bringing their children to Sunday school, But they, the parents themselves, should be teaching their children biblical truths throughout the week, right? And being the example in front of their child, coming to Sunday school themselves, right? To be a good example for their children. A righteous father teaches his son while he is young, commands and teaches proverbs to his son, and disciplines the son he delights in. We mentioned chapter 1, verse 8 already. Chapter 3, 11 and 12, if you'll turn there. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor detest his correction. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects, just as a father the son in whom he delights, in whom he loves. Should remind you of like Hebrews chapter 12, verse 6. Those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, he chastens. Huh? Yeah. But just as a father, the son in whom he delights, in whom he loves. That's a human father. Should be the same way. If we really love our children, there should be some discipline. Chapter 4, verses 1 and verse 3. Hear, my children, the instruction of a father, and give attention to no understanding. Chapter 4, verse 3. When I was my father's son, when I was my father's son, tender, and the only one in the sight of my mother. It's the idea there that he was disciplined, he was loved, he was taught. Chapter 6, verse 20, my son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Now it deals with daughters. Every time you hear son, daughters are included. Okay? Don't think that you're not included. Chapter 13, verse 1. A wise son heeds his father's instruction, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. And that's every one of us at times, too, where we think, well, maybe God's disciplining me, and that's where we have to look, and you say, Lord, you know, if it's something, that's where we got to look at our life and say, if it's some sin in my life, forgive me and deal with it and confess it, be humble, confess it, and say, yes, Lord, I know you're trying to bring repentance in my life, change me. As Hebrews 12 focuses, the fruit of it is righteousness. That's a discipline. All discipline for the moment is not joyful but sorrowful, but afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Let me go down here. Children should bring joy, not grief, to their parents, and parents should be the pride of their children. Dealing with the relationship of parents and children. Chapter 17, verse 6, look at a couple of these. This is a very common one quoted. Children's children, that is grandchildren, in other words, grandchildren, are the crown of old men, and the glory of children is their father. That's the idea there of parents should be the pride of their children. They should be the glory of their children. Earned through righteousness. Earned through godly wisdom. You know, I drive school bus, and a few weeks ago I ended up having to pick up a girl from one of the elementary schools in third grade because she was removed from her mother because she's a drug addict. That parent is not the glory of that child. Sad. And they had, sadly, in a few weeks there were several like that in the school system. Chapter 19, verse 26. He who mistreats his father and chases away his mother is a son who causes shame and brings reproach. Chapter 20, verse 20, whoever curses his father or his mother, his lamp will be put out in deep darkness. Right? We've got this in the top 10, right? In the Ten Commandments. Honor your father and your mother. So obviously it comes out in Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 10. Do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend. Now go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor nearby than a brother by far. But it deals there with the father's friend even. Of those who are the friends of your father. You have a godly parent, they should have godly friends. We'll be getting to that here with friendships. So let's go down to friendships. When you think of friendships, we say this general theme here, a wise and righteous person pays close attention to his or her friends, who they are. Okay? A wise and righteous person pays close attention to who his or her friends are. And there's bad friends and good friends. Okay? Comes out in Proverbs. Bad friends, do not be friends. It says a couple things here. Do not be friends with gluttons. Chapter 28, verse 7. The end of the verse there. But a companion of gluttons shames his father. We're not to be companions of gluttons. Friends that who have no self-control with food. That's what they eat. No self-control over what they put in their body. Don't be friends with prostitutes. Kind of that theme with adultery and all of that, with dealing with sexual sin. Look at chapter 29, verse 3. End of that verse. But a companion of harlots wastes his father's wealth. Because whoever loves wisdom makes his father rejoice. But a companion of harlots wastes his father's wealth. First Corinthians, we see it in the New Testament too. First Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33. Do not be deceived. That should let us. This is something we could deceive ourselves. Think we're right when we're not. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Because we can be deceived. Well, that's a common one. That's why he gives the warning. Don't be deceived. Why? We were deceived thinking, oh, I can handle it. It's okay. A little bit of friendship here and there with bad people, I can handle that. No big deal. It won't affect me. No, it says, don't be deceived. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. That's a tough one. We're in the world. That's the point. We're in the world, but not of the world. So we're to be kind with all, but not friends. We're to be kind to all people, be at peace with all people as far as it's possible with us, but not to be friends. And that's James 4:4. We're being an adulteress, then, or an adulterer with God in our marriage relationship with Christ if we seek to be a friend of God's enemies. So he says, do not desire the company of evil people. Look at chapter 24, verse 1. Do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them. Desire is dealing with something in our heart. Don't even desire it. Don't desire to be with them. Don't want it. Good friends. Good friends last. We see in the book of Proverbs, they last, they're sensible, they're selfless, they're forgiving, and they tell the truth. Okay? Of various things we see about good friends, good neighbors, good friends. Good friends last, chapter 27, verse 10. Beginning of that verse, do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend. Right? They last, they don't forsake one another. They're sensible. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. There are those, if you see at the end of verse 3, chapter 6, verse 3, you can go plead with your friend. When one got into an issue with pledging for a stranger, like on a loan or that. But you can go with a friend, you can talk to a friend, you can plead with them, they're sensible. Chapter 17, verse 18. End of the verse there, we're dealing with become surety for his friend. A man devoid of understanding shakes hands in a pledge and becomes surety for his friend. If you look at being selfless, chapter 3, verse 29. Do not devise evil against your neighbor, in a sense against your friend, for he dwells by you for safety's sake. That they're there to help, in a sense. Friends are good neighbors. Same with chapter 14, verse 21. He who despises his neighbor's sins, but he who has mercy on the poor, happy is he. In the sense that that the friend will be selfless and have mercy on the poor. A good friend is forgiving. If you look at chapter 10, verse 12, the end of that verse, where love covers all sins. Love covers a multitude of sins. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 8. This one here. 1 Peter 4, 8. A friend is loving, and a friend is willing to forgive. That's a sense of covering sin, is love is forgiving. That's a phrase that's used, is love covering of sin, is love is willing to forgive. Phrase that's used in 1 Peter 4, 8 and Proverbs 10, verse 12 there. A friend tells the truth. Look at chapter 27, verses 5 and 6. A friend tells the truth. Proverbs 27, verses 5 and 6. Open rebuke is someone, one who's truthful and gives you an open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. A true friend will be honest with us, even if it hurts. They'll tell us things that say, you know, I don't think that's good, or what you're planning or doing, or whatever the case may be. But faithful are the wounds of a friend. An open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Okay. I want to end with this on the friends. John chapter 15, verses 13 to 15. Hold your finger there in Proverbs. Look over to John chapter 15, verses 13 to 15. What greater friend can we have but Christ himself? John chapter 15, verses 13 to 15. Christ said, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you. And we, God's friends. If you do whatever I command you, Christ says. Similar to John 14, 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. If we're truly a loving friend, we'll seek to be obedient. Okay. Look what I did here. Whoa, there we go. I wrote it so it could just flip upside down like that. Words. Proverbs theme here is also with words. Words, like friends, words are in two kinds. There was good friends, bad friends. There's also two kinds of words. Bad or good, true or false. Be bad words and false words. There can be good words, true words, right? So, broke it up into a couple parts. What you say, what you hear. Proverbs has things to say about what we say and what we hear. Proverbs tells us we are usually destroyed by what we say with haste. With haste. Which means speaking before we think. We're usually destroyed by saying things with haste. Saying things too quickly. Saying things without thinking first. That's what Proverbs is saying to us. Okay, now what's interesting is this. God had wisdom before he did or said anything. God had wisdom before he did or said anything. Look at chapter 8, verses 22 to 31. Chapter 8, verses 22 to 31. Here we're thinking of God the Creator, right? The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I have been established from everlasting, from the beginning, before there was ever an earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth or the fields or the primal dust of the world, when he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him as a master craftsman. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men. That's wisdom crying out. See that chapter 8, verse 1. Does not wisdom cry out? Yes, wisdom cries out. Wisdom says, you know, I was there before God did anything. Because all wisdom resides in God. And it was in God before he said or did anything. Now think about us then. We also must seek wisdom then before we speak and before we act. We also must seek to be wise first. Look at chapter 14, verse 8. And this is against the fool. The fool thinks it's all in his speaking. Right? Okay. Chapter 14, verse 8. The wisdom of the prudent is to understand his way, but the folly of fools is deceit. Look at chapter 14, verse 15. The end of the verse there, chapter 14, verse 15, end of the verse. But the prudent, the wise, prudence another word for wise, but the prudent, the wise, considers well his steps. He's considering his steps before he acts. Same with his speech then. He's considering what he's going to say before he says it. Chapter 21, verse 29. The end of the verse there, but as for the upright, he establishes his way. He establishes it through being wise first. Think of the New Testament, James chapter 1, verse 19. Right? James 1, 19. James is really a book of wisdom for the New Testament, as we've talked about before. But James 1, 19. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And deal with speaking, we're to be slow to speak. We're to think first. We're to have wisdom first. Okay? That's why I'm also going to mention this on hearing. Right? What does it say there? James 1:19. Be swift to hear. Be quick to hear. Slow to speak, slow to wrath, slow to anger. Be quick to hear. Wisdom, we'll say this here on our hearing, wisdom is not found through speaking words. Wisdom is not found through speaking words as the fool thinks. Rather, wisdom is found through listening to the words of others. That's where wisdom is found. You read a book. You're listening to the words of somebody else who wrote those words. Right now, you're listening to words of another. This is true of human beings, not God. God is the only untaught original mind in the universe. But any wisdom found in us is found through listening to others. Look at chapter 10, verse 8. Chapter 1, verse 8, I brought up, my son, hear the instruction of your father, right? Got to listen. Chapter 10, verse 8, the wise in heart will receive commands. Chapter 13, verse 13, he who despises the word will be destroyed, but he who fears the commandment will be rewarded. He who listens to the commandment, chapter 19, verse 16, he who keeps the commandment keeps his soul, but he who is careless of his ways will die. Now, we have brought up many times that's why keeping is involved, obeying is involved with hearing. James 1:22, right? To hear and not do is really not to hear, right? Look at James 1:22. Turn over there. James 1:22. That's why the book of Proverbs is talking about hearing. It's talking about keeping. It's talking about obeying. That gets brought into it. James 1:22. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Because if we really hear and understand, we will do, right? To hear and not do is not to hear at all, as we've heard Pastor Ron say several times. But it's listening to the words of others and doing and obeying. Life and death. Life and death. Last section here. Two roads are presented. Roads take us to certain locations. And many times they're named after where they will take us. There is a way that takes one to death, and there is another way that takes one to life. The way to life is to know wisdom, to do righteousness, and fear the Lord. That comes out in the book of Proverbs. And to follow one of those is to follow the others. They're together in the book of Proverbs. To know wisdom is to fear the Lord. To fear the Lord is to do righteousness. To do righteousness is to know wisdom. That's the way of life. Proverbs knows we need more than instruction. It is necessary but not sufficient. Our sin hinders our prayers and our sacrifices, our worship. You look at chapter 15, verse 8. In other words, think about it this way. The book of Proverbs knows we need more than instruction because we're sinners. Because I'm a sinner, I need more than just somebody telling me what I ought to do or know. I need more than that. Because I'm a sinner, sin has to be addressed. Our sin hinders our prayers and sacrifices. Look at chapter 15, verse 8. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but the prayer of the upright is his delight. Also, 1 Samuel 15, 22 is a cross-reference. The prophet Samuel said to Saul, to obey is better than sacrifice, to obey is better than worship. That's what he's saying here. In Proverbs chapter 15, verse 8, that the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, that the worship, any worship of God by the wicked is an abomination. But the prayer of the upright is his delight. Chapter 21, verse 27. Same thing. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. How much more when he brings it with wicked intent? Chapter 28, verse 9. When he turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer is an abomination. Even his prayer is an abomination if he turns away his ear from hearing the law. God is a just judge. God is a just judge. Look at chapter 24, verse 12. If you say, surely we did not know this, does not he, with capital H there, does not God who weighs the hearts consider it? What is God concerned with? Assessing us first and foremost with our hearts, right? Does not he, God who weighs the hearts consider it? He who keeps your soul, does he not know it? And will he not render to each man according to his deeds? Luke 23:41 God rendering to each man according to his deeds. That's a definition of justice. Each one gets proportional punishment. What does one deserve? You got the thief on the cross, Luke 23:41, who was able to say, you know, we're getting what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. Christ, he knew Christ was righteous. But he knew he was getting justice for his wicked deeds. God is the just judge, and he renders to each man according to his deeds. He knows what's in our hearts. Proverbs says we're all sinners and debtors. Look at chapter 20, verse 9. This is a statement made with a rhetorical question. Who can say, I have made my heart clean, I am pure from my sin? None of us. That's a cross-reference for Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, right? None of us can say that we have made our heart clean, that we are pure from sin. There's an emphasis on the heart again. But by confessing sin and repenting, we receive mercy. That's in Proverbs. By confessing sin and repenting, we receive mercy. Look at chapter 28, verse 13. He who covers his sins will not prosper, trying to hide them. But whoever confesses and forsakes them will have mercy. Whoever confesses his sins and forsakes them, repents, will have mercy. Chapter 28, verse 13. Also, cross-reference there is chapter 29, verse 1. That he who is often rebuked, hardens his neck, will suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. What's implied there is we need to confess sin. We need to confess sin and forsake them, and God will have mercy. And through love and faithfulness, through mercy and truth, depending on your English translation there, sin is atoned for. Chapter 16, verse 6. Chapter 16, verse 6. In mercy and truth, in love and faithfulness, some English translations have, but in mercy and truth, atonement is provided for iniquity. And by the fear of the Lord, one departs evil. And we know ultimately that's pointing to Christ. But look at chapter 4, verse 18 and 19. There's two ways presented again. Two ways in front of us. There's no third option. Chapter 4, verses 18 and 19. But the path of the just, the path of the righteous, is like the shining sun, that shines ever brighter onto the perfect day. But the way of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know what makes them stumble. It's a beautiful picture, though, like a sunrise of a righteous person learning godly wisdom. The path of the just, the path of the righteous, is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter. Think of progressive sanctification, forming Christ ever more within us, getting ever brighter as we get closer to the celestial city. The brightness of Christ shining forth ever brighter as we become more and more sanctified and holy on our way in our pilgrimage to the heavenly city. Look at chapter 8, 35 and 36. Chapter 8, this again is wisdom crying out in chapter 8. For whoever finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me wrongs his own soul. All those who hate me love death. And it makes me think of Elijah, prophet Elijah on Mount Carmel confronting the prophets of Baal. This idea of choose this day whom you will serve, right? If he is the Lord, serve him. 1 Kings 18:21. Christ is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. Christ is the wisdom of God. It is in Christ, Colossians 2:3, that all the treasures are hidden, all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. In Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, Colossians 2, verse 3. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 to 24. That it is foolishness, right? Foolishness to the Greeks, stumbling blocks to the Jews, word of the cross. Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, John 14:6. He is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through him. Christ destroyed death and brought life and immortality to light. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 10. Christ is the one who has brought life and immortality to light. And Christ came that we may have life and have it to the full, have it more abundantly. John chapter 10, verse 10. The good life. Again, all in the Bible is Christ in all. It's meant to point us to Christ. In its own way, Proverbs does. There's a lot there in Proverbs, but hopefully when you read Proverbs, you think about these overall themes that are there, and may God give every one of us the humility to not lean on our own understanding, but to trust in God, to look to him for godly wisdom, to read it and say, teach me, grant me understanding, help me to submit to your loving discipline in my life, to heed it. And may I shine ever brighter with each passing day. May Christ within me through the Holy Spirit shine brighter as God sanctifies us and makes us more holy. Pastor Ron.